This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast, where we explore how to center our lives and our leadership in the love of God revealed in Jesus Christ.
In the midst of the disruptive cultural shockwaves of the 21st century.
Join us as we learn to take the love of God seriously as the force that holds all of us and everything together.
Hey, everybody, welcome to the Gravity Podcast. Matt, welcome to you.
Thank you, and to you as well.
Thank you. Christy's not with us today, unfortunately.
She's dissertating.
She is dissertating. She learned that she had to do some more research on one of her chapters, and is doing the research. So
yeah, we've got something special, though, in store.
We do. Over the next 3 weeks.
A little summer special. It's kind of a Christmas in July.
Oh yeah. This is, you guys are going to love the present that we got for you listeners.
One of the most listened to series we've ever done. I think it's the most listened to series we've ever done was,
it was crazy. Yeah.
Was, something we did on critical race theory a few years back with Dr. Nathan Cartagena, who teaches at Wheaton College. Mm-hmm. And we decided that I've listened to this four-part series, I don't know, three or four times all the way through. And we decided that a lot of our listeners may be new to our podcast or don't have time to listen through the hundreds of past episodes. We decided here in the middle of summer, while you're on sabbatical, you're going on vacation.
I'm going on vacation.
Every other day, it seems like, Ben.
Yeah, I do have a lot of vacations planned.
Keep vacating. So. That we would
just leave in the place.
Replay this podcast and do, listen to it 2 years later. You remember a couple of years ago, critical race theory was the big bugaboo.
Yeah.
It was the thing that people were taking aim at. Now it's still, there's still policies, legislators, educational, school board kind of things, kerfuffles that are dealing with critical race theory. But you'll notice that the rhetoric has shifted towards transgender people, transgenderism, and drag queens, right? So that's now maybe more front and center.
They're the bad guys, or the scapegoats, the current scapegoats.
Yes. Yeah. But there was so much work Nathan did in this series to walk through the history of the United States when it comes to race and white supremacy, that no matter if critical race theory is in the news or not, it is complete. People pay for this education, and you're going to get it for free.
Yep.
You might have
all you got to do is tune in.
Yep. You might have to listen to a Metamucil commercial here and there in the middle of it. You know
whatever
what I mean?
Whatever our ad platform decides, but still,
I want to say too that I've heard from people who found our podcast because they went through an anti-racism curriculum, and this four-part series was in an anti-racism curriculum.
Yeah,
I've had people message me who are taking college classes, and this four-part series was a part of their required, quote, reading or listening for the college class. So a lot of people have found Gravity through this series, and a lot of people outside of Gravity have recognized the incredible value that Dr. Cartagena provided for us on this series.
Yeah. Yeah. He gave us a lot of his time. It's extremely generous. And just to like, so during the kerfuffle, you know, everybody's like, what is critical race theory? And it was, you know, it was definitely being weaponized, you know, as a basically, you know, who was the guy who tweeted about it? He actually just
Christopher Rufo.
Yeah. Yeah. It was like a strategist, political strategist for the Republican Party who just said like, our goal is for anything crazy that anybody hears about to be labeled critical race theory. And they sort of like poison the water, essentially. And the irony was that critical race theory, it actually is something that if you're committed to white supremacy, you should be afraid of, because essentially what it does is it goes through the history, specifically the history of law, and it's a law discipline.
Yeah.
And looking at U.S. law and discerning sort of the racist threads in U.S. law. So Dr. Cartagena is a critical race scholar. It's like what he studies. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's incredible because he walks us through just so much. I mean, I felt like I was drinking from a fire hose. Like when we were recording this, I was just like, oh, okay. Yep. We just kept going and we're like, well, we have to make this. It was going to be a one-parter and turned into four parts.
We could not fit it into one part.
Yeah. So anyway, I think it'll be interesting to kind of revisit this 2 years later. We were first recorded these in May of 2021. And there's four parts. The first part is basically an introduction to critical race theory. What is it? Second part is, parts two and three are an application of critical race theory. And Nathan Cartagena walks us through the history of white supremacy in the United States, mm-hmm. Looking at various laws. Extremely eye-opening.
Yeah.
There's no way after listening to this, like this is just like this. He just like is quoting like laws in the United States. So it's not like it's controversial. Not like speculation. It's like, these are the laws that were on the books and he just walks us through. And after listening to this, there's no way that you'd be able to say that America was founded on anything other than white supremacy.
Yeah.
That is our legacy. And then part four is all about like, why should Christians care about this? What does this matter for the church? How do we apply this? Like, what does the gospel have to do with this? So,
yeah.
So anyway, that's what we're doing. We're going to release these four episodes over the next 3 weeks.
So, yeah. And I sent you two links, Ben. One is a New Yorker article about what Christopher Rufo did, and then another is a Media Matters article that just has the screenshots of the tweets. I'm not sure we even talked about these in our
I don't think we did.
Series, but maybe by way of last words before we get into this, I'll just read you this Christopher Rufo tweet. He says, the goal is to have the public read something crazy in the newspaper and immediately think, quote, critical race theory. We have decodified the term and will recodify it to annex the entire range of cultural constructions that are unpopular with Americans. And that gets quote tweeted. And somebody says, Christopher Rufo has become one of the go-to critics of critical race theory. Here he is, essentially giving away the game. For Rufo, it is all about branding, and the audacity of his charlatanry is breathtaking. And then Rufo quote tweets that and says, yes, I envisioned a strategy, turn the brand critical race theory toxic, and despite having virtually no resources compared to my opponents, willed it into being through writing and persuasion.
Oh, gosh.
So, we got to get out of here, but this is how fascism works.
Yeah.
This is post-truth propaganda that is seeking to weaponize a tool used for liberation to make it be a tool of oppression.
Yeah.
This is how fascism works. And in 2023, friends, I don't have to tell you this, we're still in a place that we're exceedingly vulnerable to fascist propaganda like this. So open your ear holes. Get ready.
Get ready for the fire hose. There's two different metaphors there.
I know.
You don't want the fire hose. You don't want water in your ears, probably.
You don't. No.
Yeah. Anyway.
Get ready.
Get ready for some good things to come to you through this audio program.
Let's get out of here.
How's that?
All right. Dr. Nathan Luis Cartagena, welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast.
Thank you. It's a joy to be with you all.
Yes. Nathan is the assistant professor of philosophy at Wheaton College in Wheaton, Illinois, and he teaches on race and justice and political philosophy. He also is the faculty advisor for a student group that's working to enhance Christian unity and celebrate Latina and Latino cultures there at Wheaton. Nathan, what else do we need to know about you?
Well, let me start by, again, saluting the great work you all are doing at Gravity Leadership. I'm honored to join you all. I also think it's important to acknowledge what ancestral lands one is on. So I am coming from the ancestral lands of the Ojibwe, the Ottawa, and the Potawatomi. I'll note that I am multiracialized. My mom's family are what in Spanish we'd call Anglos. They are coming from the U.S. South, places like North Florida, Georgia, South Carolina, hills of Tennessee. My dad's entire family, they come from Boricua or Puerto Rico. And though I was born in South Carolina, my family moved from there to Philadelphia and then to New Jersey. So I spent most of my life in New Jersey. And one of the reasons that's going to be important is the racialization practices in the Northeast are different than they would be in other places. So one of the reasons I became interested in race scholarship is because I was trying to understand myself. So as we sometimes say, the research was the me search. And I was routinely racialized as Black growing up, even though I'm quite light skinned. And part of this has to do with the historic linkings of the Puerto Rican community with the African American community in places like New York, New York City, New Jersey. So again, the location matters. But I'd note that because of that racialization and my in fact embracing it, there were lots of tensions that came because again, my mom's family, they're from the South. My mom's parents were born and raised in the Jim Crow South. They were socialized into that form of Anglo-white supremacy. And perhaps your listeners don't know, but racism, forms of white supremacy are also a major problem in Latino and Latina communities. And so when I was talking to my abuela and my abuelo, my grandparents down in Puerto Rico, Boricua, and I would say, oh yeah, you know what, I'm Black. They weren't too pleased. We could say they weren't too pleased at all. So I was attempting to understand, how is it that I'm being racialized Black? In some places I'm being racialized white. In some places I'm being racialized as a non-white Latino in other places. And it was chaos. And I found that there were few people that had helpful answers. And it really wasn't until I was at Texas A&M in my first year of my master's program that I started to encounter some of these helpful answers. And the person that helped me to get onto the road of having more understanding about the world that I was inhabiting was Dr. Tommy J. Curry, who was at Texas A&M. Now he is at Edinburgh. He's founded the first ever Black Male Studies Institute at Edinburgh. But he's the one who, in fact, said, well, given some of your interest, and I shared that I was from Puerto Rico, he's like, yeah, I think you might find critical race theory interesting. And I think he just knew, because of the unique relationship that Puerto Rico has to the United States, Puerto Rico being the oldest colony in the world. It's a place that has taxation without representation. You can't, if you live on the island, vote for president, vice president, no members of Congress, et cetera. And it's become a major place of exploitation. But it was, in fact, designed to be that, going all the way back until the Treaty of Paris that the United States signs with Spain. So I think Dr. Curry knew there are going to be a lot of interesting legal connections, and he knew that critical race theorists were paying close attention to racialization practices. Dr. Curry is actually a student of Derrick Bell, who's often seen as the founding father of critical race theory. So he said, yeah, you should be interested in these. Read these people. Don't read those people. Let me know if you have any questions. So that was the beginning of my interests in thinking about critical race theory and race scholarship in general. So again, it was research that followed from my attempts to understand myself, my family, the histories, the reasons why, though, for example, my mama or grandma loved me dearly. I was in many senses very close to her. Problems of white supremacy always surfaced in our conversations. They'd come up in unexpected times. There were occasions where my mama would ask why I had so many Black friends, for example. There were times where she would suggest that the Bible condemns having such friends. It was wild, and I didn't understand it. And my parents weren't at that point equipped to help me to understand it. And the church that I was attending wasn't helping me understand it. So again, in an effort to understand myself and the world, I started reading and digesting race scholarship. So those, I think, are some background details to note.
Yeah, that's great, Nathan. We are having you on this podcast because you have studied critical race theory, and it's kind of a big deal right now. Maybe this is the first you're hearing about it, but critical race theory, or CRT, which we're going to give a brief definition of this week, and we're going to really unpack next week. critical race theory has become sort of a dividing line among Christians. Some people see it as a very helpful tool. Some people see it as the greatest danger to the Western Church, you know, since, I don't know, the last boogeyman. and so, Nathan, before we get to maybe a really simple, I know it's hard to define critical race theory because it's such a diverse and variegated field. But before we do that, you mentioned the church you went to as a kid didn't really help you understand these questions about who am I and how do I understand myself. Could you give us a brief sketch of what your faith was like growing up?
Sure. So both my parents are Christians, so I was born and raised in a Christian home. Their parents were also Christians, and going back, their parents were Christians. So Christians going way, way, way back for generations. Because of my mom's experiences growing up, where her parents would go to various sorts of churches, they didn't have a denominational affiliation. They were often just trying to go to a congregation that they thought was faithfully preaching the Bible. And my dad, he was actually a child of a father who was in the military. My abuelo ends up joining the military in part to try to get out of generational problems and poverty. His parents died when he was really young, so he was raised by my tío Ramón, so my uncle Ramón. And often down in Puerto Rico, when you are in the position that my abuelo was in, it's either you go to trade school or you're going to join the military. These are the options. So he joins the military. So that means that my dad, my abuela, my uncle, my tío, they moved all over the United States, depending on what the Air Force had. So they didn't also have really strong denominational connections. They were just trying to find churches where they thought people were faithfully preaching the Bible. So this is relevant because when we settle in New Jersey, my parents don't have strong denominational ties, but they want to find a place that's faithfully proclaiming the word. And so they end up settling on a conservative Baptist church that in terms of the members was actually, it was kind of like a multiracial, multi-ethnic congregation, but at the leadership, the majority of people were racialized white, and they didn't have much of an understanding of, well, they certainly weren't robust, let's say, anti-racist. And in fact, when I say that I didn't get much help on race matters, not only did I not get much help, but when it was clear that race was in view, it was often in ways that were maintaining forms of white supremacy. I'll just give you two examples of what I mean. I remember one time in an attempt to defend the power of the gospel, a leader said, now imagine you're in a dark alley and a bunch of black men walk towards you. So they're playing on racist fears about black males. Yeah. And then the person said, now imagine you somehow find out that they're leaving a Bible study. Won't you feel better? So that you get the fear of the black male, the racist tropes about how violent and dangerous they are, and then how the gospel in some ways civilized them and gets all this nastiness out of them. Mm-hmm. So that sort of thing would come up. But there was also a time we were at a summer camp, and I kept noticing that the youth leaders were paying very close attention to the few of us that were there that were racialized minorities. And so I ended up asking one of the youth leaders why this was the case, and the youth leader said, well, some people need more watching than others. And so what I knew was there were racist ideas about our sexuality and how promiscuous we would or would not be. So those things would surface. But I'd also say that one of the marks of this congregation was that people earnestly loved the Lord, but there were powerful strains of not only forms of white supremacy and racism that would surface in ways like I've just mentioned, but there was also some pretty serious anti-intellectualism, not with everybody, but it was certainly there. So I ended up going and doing my undergrad at Grove City College, which is known for having a pretty Presbyterian/Reformed biblical studies department. And it ends up that was one of the things that I majored in, biblical theological studies, also majored in philosophy. But my time there involved me spending developing a mentor relationship with Dr. Ian Duguid, who's now at Westminster Theological Seminary in Philly. He's an Old Testament guy, specialty is Ezekiel. And he writes on other books of the Bible too, of course. But through spending time with him, I moved towards the Reform trajectory. And so I'd say probably my freshman year. I had been interested in Reformed theology, but I didn't know much about covenant theology and things like this until I was at Grove City. And then after Grove City, between then and the time that I finished my PhD at Baylor, I became what people like Douglas F. Kelly or J. Todd Billings call Reformed Catholics. So the Catholic here is lowercase c, and its emphasis on the universal church. And frankly, that didn't just fit some of my theological training, we might say, because I did a dissertation on Thomas Aquinas, but it also fit my experience of being in very different racialized churches, being member of very different racialized families, and seeing how different the cultures were, how different some of the theologies were, but also seeing, okay, well, these people are Christian. They're going to be jots and tittles I'm strongly disagreeing with, but no, I see the Spirit at work here, and I sense the Spirit's present there, etc. So I've often had a pretty capacious conception of the church. So that will surface time and again as we dialogue about CRT,
sure.
Because I'm one who, like many Reformed people, certainly holds the Bible in really high regard, but is also going to hold in high regard what we might call general revelation and the ways in which human beings, whether they're Christians or not, know things. And I just know that's not true of every tradition, that's part of the church, but it's definitely true of me.
That's great, Nathan. Well, I want to return to, and I think the historical context you're going to give us for why a tool like CRT is important, I want to return to these Bible-believing, well-meaning, Jesus-loving Christians. How can they be so racist and not know it? I want to return to that because I think it's the perplexing thing for many white people. Many white people don't want to be racist. They don't want to have racist ideas. And it's they get angry or frustrated or irritated when they realize that they don't know what they don't know about it. I think that's one of the things that your historical sketch will help us have a greater appreciation for is how could that happen? How could that happen to good people, right? Good people. But first, critical race theory. I know you could spend 40 minutes talking about it, but could you give us a working, simple definition so that when we mention it or talk about it, people have something to correlate it to? Maybe like 60 seconds, 90 seconds?
Yeah, I'd like to do that. And here my time with Thomas Aquinas is going to show. So I want to help your reader, your audience by distinguishing three senses of critical race theory. Three senses of critical race theory. So there's what me as a Thomas will call CRT proper. What was critical race theory at its origins, and what is, in the most important sense, properly CRT? So here's a definition. Critical race theory is a legal movement aimed at understanding, resisting, and remediating how U.S. law and legal institutions, such as law schools, have fostered and perpetuated racism and white supremacy. So it's a movement that's going to house multiple traditions. Those traditions themselves will house multiple and competing theories, as the traditions sometimes are going to be competing, sometimes even inconsistent. So you have diversity, not just in terms of the racialization of the members, but in terms of the traditions and the theories and the methods that people will employ. It's connected to law and efforts to understand how U.S. law specifically perpetuates forms of racism and white supremacy.
So then, for instance, like how does Brown versus the Board of Education, how does that law or that ruling, how does that perpetuate systemic injustice?
Right. So there are going to be questions about how does that ruling fit within the broader legal history of the United States as, and we'll say much more about this, but as a white nation, intentionally designed to be white empire, white republic, We'll say more about it, but okay, what was that? How is that ruling breaking from certain things that have gone before? Mm-hmm. Like, for example, the U.S. had before that, through Plessy v. Ferguson, federal racial apartheid.
Yes.
So it's not just the South Africans of the world that had racial apartheid. No, the United States had racial apartheid through Plessy v. Ferguson. But in fact, the United States has racial apartheid before that, especially if you pay close attention to the laws and the practices the United States is going to establish as it relates to indigenous communities. Again, we'll say more about that. But then there are questions about, okay, well, once that decision comes, how does the U.S. implement the decision? And then what subsequent laws and court decisions inform how that decision is going to operate? So how much power do subsequent laws and decisions grant that decision, or how much do they whittle it down? And this is going to be very important because one of the things that critical race theorists will highlight is you often get the following pattern. You get reform followed by entrenchment.
Yes.
So I will give you two. I'll give you three examples that should help your audience. So one, you think about after the U.S. Civil War, you get Reconstruction period, and it's like, hooray, this is going to work, and then it comes crashing down with the Hayes Compromise,
yes.
and the withdrawal of federal troops, And it's a pretty steep trajectory from that to Plessy v. Ferguson. So reform, entrenchment. Then you think of Brown v. Board. Okay, it looks like we got some reform, but wait a second. Even 10 years after that, we're still getting certain forms of civil rights legislation, 64, 65, for example. So you go, whoa, what's going on in that 10-year period? And one of the things that you find is there's further entrenchment. So for example, Nixon ends up putting four justices on the court who are, we might say, politically conservative, but they're not just politically conservative. They're picking up, and I'm going to say much more about this in our second interview, but they're picking up on what are known as Barry Goldwater's tactics of maintaining racism and white supremacy, but not always being explicit about it.
Yeah, coding.
So you use what are known as dog whistle politics.
Yes.
So these are people many of these judges are going to be down with that sort of stuff. And you're going to get the development of all sorts of institutions that are going to work to maintain what's going to be seen as Western civilization, which is often a coded term, and other forms of white supremacy. So it's like, hooray, things are getting better. But then as you watch from Nixon to Reagan, you get the development of all sorts of dog whistles, racist tropes, racist strategies. And so it's another form of entrenchment. And then you could think of something like this. More recently, you have President Obama, the first black president, the first African-American president, immediately followed by the forms of racist entrenchment that we're seeing, that we saw with President Trump, and the rise of violent white nationalism, et cetera, et cetera. So looks like reform right into retrenchment. And again, there's actually a lot that I would offer as a critique of Obama, but these are the sorts of things that critical race theorists are paying attention to, and specifically asking, how is the law operating through those forms of entrenchment?
And now a word from a sponsor.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
All right, let's get back into our conversation.
It seems to me that this is a helpful corrective to the myth we tell ourselves, which is we had segregated schools until Brown v. Board, and now it's better. Or we had no civil rights for black people until the civil rights legislation in 1964, and now they have civil rights. Right? Is that what CRT is trying to do, is trying to complexify a very simple mythological understanding?
Yes, so that's part of it. So the founder, Derrick Bell, he actually he's a Korean War veteran, goes to law school. He ends up working with the NAACP. So he's actually close with Medgar Evers. He's close with Thurgood Marshall, and he ends up doing desegregation cases down in the South. And there are times where he's with Medgar Evers, and they're in a house. And that while they're trying to sleep, Bell's on the couch. There's somebody with a shotgun defending them so that they can get some sleep. So that, like, Bell was in the struggle in a thick way. But when he decided he was going to do desegregation work, one of his mentors says, well, you know, we're pretty much just at mop-up duty. There's not going to be much to do. So Bell's like, oh, okay, well, I'm still going to go down and do this as long as I can. And as the years go by, Bell's like, wait a second. It's not getting much better. And he's seeing the extreme forms of violent white resistance. So the Bull Connors of the world, for example, the George Wallaces of the world. And then he sees the ways in which the courts are working to what he's going to end up calling establish a kind of interest convergence, where it's like, well, we'll give as much power, rights, privilege to racialized minorities as the racialized white majority is going to allow us to do. And that's going to be connected to visions of international competition with communist countries is often how it's going to be presented, but especially, for example, Russia. Yes. So there's a lot that's going on there, but they are trying to impact that. But one of the things I want to stress is most of the founding CRT folks are racialized minorities who are going to be in some of those first efforts to establish things like affirmative action. So they're going to be some of the first people in places like a Harvard and a Virginia law school, et cetera, et cetera. And they're looking at this going, where are the fellow racialized minority students? Where are the fellow racialized minority faculty? What's going on with the hiring practices? How come all of these things that How come so many of the practices are specifically designed to support these people, but not these other people? And this is happening in terms of class, and it's happening in terms of race, and it's happening in terms of gender. So it's an effort to understand how legal practices, legal institutions are fostering these forms of white supremacy that they're going to get that critical race theory gets up and running. So yeah, that's right.
Yeah, it sounds like they developed a sociological tool to help them make sense of their experiences in their life, much like you found CRT to help you make sense of your experiences in your life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'll add a little bit to that. So somebody like Derek Bell is drawing heavily from people like Du Bois, W.E.B. Du Bois. Mm-hmm. Bell is connected to what Cedric Robinson will call the Black radical tradition. So it's an effort to pay close attention to the broader African diaspora and say, okay, how in this country do we see white supremacy promoting forms of racial subordination, racial subjugation, racial oppression, racial exploitation? So Bell is extending insights that you're going to get from Du Bois into his legal practice. But then somebody like Robert A. Williams, who's of the Lumbee tribe, which is still to this day not a federally recognized tribe, he's going to be asking questions like, okay, as a student of Derek Bell that's learning so much about the connections between law and race, how do I take all of these deep insights that I have from various indigenous communities? And how do I apply some of what I'm learning from Bell and other groups to try to care for my communities and try to promote their rights? So he's going in that direction. Then you get somebody like Kimberly Crenshaw, who's also going to be operating out of the Black radical tradition in various senses. So she wanted to get to study with Bell, but Bell ends up leaving Harvard Law School and goes to be a dean at the University of Oregon when Crenshaw is at Harvard. But while she's there, one of the things that she notes is, okay, not only do we have to ask questions about what's going on with race, but how are race and gender, we might say, intersections and overlaps, how are they performing unique challenges and forms of subordination, forms of, frankly, legal blind spots? So her first piece on intersectionality is an effort to understand, for example, why you'll get a range of laws designed to protect white female chastity and sexuality, but there are no similar laws for Black female chastity, sexuality. Mm-hmm. She's going, what in the world is happening here? Mm-hmm. And she's highlighting those forms of legal, not only white supremacy, but now they're clear forms of gendered racism. And of course, other people are going to say, yep, you'll find similar things applying to men, not identical, but similar. But yeah. So these are some of the concerns that they have. This might be a perfect time actually to segue into the second sense. So I gave the CRT proper. One of the things I want to highlight is in the early 90s, there are, especially in education, the discipline of education, people finding CRT scholarship, because the CRT movement officially launches in the summer of 1989. So this is still relatively new, but it officially launches in the summer of 1989. Again, all the people connected to it are doing law, except Cornel West, who's just everywhere. Cornel West has got his hands in everything.
He's amazing.
As certain education scholars find this, they're like, oh, there are insights in this movement. There are ideas that we would like to have and we want to apply. So this is the part, this is what I call CRT in the derivative senses. Hmm. So the question that you ask, or that I'm going to ask as a student of the Palestinian scholar Edward Said, is how does CRT as the movement and some of the theories, some of the methods, how do they travel into other disciplines? And what you find is in education, for example, some people like Gloria Lanson Billings are saying, let's pay close attention to law, let's get steeped in CRT proper, and then we're going to do more of an effort to think through how some of these insights relate to education. Other people are perhaps making extended stays, but they're going to want to what they'll call reinvent, and it's in part because of certain education theories that they're studying. So, for example, Daniel Salzano, who's at UCLA, he's going to say, yep, I find Bell really helpful, but because I'm a student of Paulo Freire, who is a Brazilian Christian and educator, he said, well, Paulo says what we have to do is reinvent the ideas that we inherit to make sure that what we're doing is addressing the actual conditions of our communities. So he's open about the fact that he takes CRT and importantly reinvents it. So what he's doing, though it's CRT in an important sense, it's different than what you're getting Lanson Billings doing, and it's certainly different than what you're going to be doing, what you're going to see somebody like Derek Bell doing. So I'm going to be asking questions about how it travels, and I'll say one more thing about that. When I was first talking to Dr. Tommy Curry about CRT. One of the things that he said is CRT, as it's been brought into philosophy, has been gentrified. Hmm. And so he helped me to see that scholars like Shannon Sullivan were taking the moniker CRT, frankly, just emptying it out and doing what they wanted to do as race scholars. And so when you look at their texts, you will find not a single citation, quotation, or naming of a CRT author, text, etc. Yeah. But it gets labeled CRT, and then you know, you get critical race studies that comes later in philosophy, or critical philosophy of race, etc. There are a whole bunch of things that get similar. It's why you have to be very careful when you're talking about CRT, because some people want to just lump all of that under it, and we shouldn't, because they're not equivalent. So Dr. Curry helped me to see that it's going to be important to interrogate how any manifestation of CRT in another academic discipline, in another movement, does or does not relate to the sorts of things that I'm calling CRT proper. So I'm still going to grant the sort of things that we're seeing in education or in philosophy are CRT, but they're a CRT in a different sense.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's a supremely extended sense. Like, well, this person will on occasion quote Derrick Bell, but that's about it. Like there's yeah. no real robust sense in which the person has identified with the CRT movement, has really made an extended stay with the authors, sees herself or himself trying to extend the insights of that movement. But unfortunately for many people, that it's not to the point where they think that anybody is doing any kind of race scholarship or believes, for example, that systemic racism exists is just a CRTer. And that's really far from the truth.
Yeah.
So if I could just give you one example, there's an important sense in which Mark Knoll is a kind of race scholar when he's working on the Civil War as a theological crisis. Because he's writing on race in the United States. He's writing on how forms of biblicism are completely failing to adjudicate massive political and ecclesiastical questions. And he's thinking through white supremacy and racialized chattel slavery. But there is no important sense in which Mark Knoll is a critical race theorist.
Right.
He wouldn't have identified as one. But if you ask, well, are you doing race scholarship? He'd say yes. If you ask, well, do you believe in systemic racism? Yes. In fact, I'm studying it but in this 19th century form. So I want to give that as an example because it helps. I think it might help your listeners see, oh, whoa, that's right. In fact, a lot of people were doing race scholarship going way before the Mark Knowles of the world. Of course, like somebody like Frederick Douglass, I'll just give an example. He's doing what I would call race scholarship, no doubt about it. He's decrying the forms of white Christian nationalism. He's decrying the forms of what we now would call systemic racism. And he's doing that in the mid-19th century. So we really want to pause, I think, for some of your audience and ask, if you are the sort of person who thinks that any talk about racism and white supremacy and ideas about whiteness just has to equal CRT. You want to ask, what happened to your, why did you not get exposed to all these other forms of race scholarship that are making similar claims, not identical? Mm-hmm. They're perhaps not studying the ways in which law is promoting white supremacy, but why has this not been on your radar in the same way? And this is going to get connected to something that critical race theorist Kendall Thomas calls organized forgetting. So it's the ways in which institutions and broader, practices in a society put certain things before us so that we know them and then hide other things from us so that we don't know them. Yes. And every society is engaging in forms of organized forgetting. So that if you go to a seminary, for example, let's say you do an MDiv, you're like, okay, I'm here for 3 or 4 years. These are the things I need to know to be a pastor. This is what this is implicit mm-hmm. thought. So if you don't ever get a class on race, like a whole class on race and white supremacy and colonialism, mm-hmm. and maybe at places like Westminster, Philadelphia, you might not even get a full class period. Not just a course, but like you might not even get a full class period, a whole hour or 3 hours on discussions of race. Yeah. Well, then it just doesn't seem like it's that relevant. So right. Notice what's gone on. The people that are training you are suggesting it's not relevant. The people that were training them are suggesting it's not relevant. You probably have gone to churches and nobody was suggesting that racism and white supremacy were major problems. They might say, well, those things are bad, but they're not saying that they're major problems that have greatly shaped or manifested in the United States. And then you go in and you're doing pastoral ministry. And if those are your views, more than likely your congregants aren't thinking that these things are a big problem. So mm-hmm. see what happens. You get this stuff passed down so that, for example, there are times where I talk to, in many senses, highly educated Reformed people, and they don't know anything about the doctrine of discovery, for example. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to say a little bit about this in a few moments, but I go, how do you not know anything about this? And when I say, for example, well, it's actually the church that's had one of the most important influences in spreading white supremacy across the whole globe. Mm-hmm. They're like, but white supremacy is the KKK. So how did the church? And I'm like, no. White supremacy was around 400 years plus before the KKK. Yeah. And they're like, oh, I don't know what you're talking about. And they might think, for example, that racism is just about hatred, rather than think of all these forms of benevolent racism that you're going to see time and again in the 19th century. Especially those of us from Puerto Rico, we know about how the white empire likes to talk about being the white savior for us, you mongrel people that are just so backwards and barbarous, et cetera, et cetera. But they don't know about this. So for many pastors in particular, pastors and priests, excuse me, they're like, how is it that I don't know any of these things? And this gets into the systemic and institutional realities.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. So this gets back to that opening question you raised, Matt, about how is it that so many people don't know these things? As I was saying, I was in fact in New Jersey in a multiracialized congregation in terms of the members, and these things just weren't ever coming up.
Yeah.
So if you then have the experiences that I'm having, you're like, racism is a huge problem. I'm in sixth grade and I have a teacher flat out telling me that I don't belong in this honors English class. It was my first ever honors English class in my sixth grade again. And it's week one. And she's like, you don't belong in this class. You're only here for racial diversity numbers. It's my task to get you out of here. And that,
dude,
she did not let up on that idea the whole year. The whole year. So that class was hell from week one all the way through the rest of the 180 something days that we had in public school. Yeah. And this is a public school. Right. Yeah. This is a public school, and in New Jersey, we're not talking about
the deep south.
This is the deep south.
So, when I looked at that, as I was experiencing those things, I didn't have people to talk to. And if I make a righteous noise against the forms of racist oppression and abuse that I'm experiencing, one of the things that I'm going to hear is, "Oh, that doesn't have to do with the gospel. What are you talking about? Oh, no, that it's just maybe a bad apple, et cetera, et cetera." Mm. Well, you can think that when you have these other forms of organized forgetting and social realities that are making it hard.
We'll be right back.
The Gravity Podcast is sponsored by the Gravity Formation Course, our 12-month cohort-based training in practical spiritual formation, where you'll learn how to notice how God is already at work in your life so you can participate more fully in the life that God shares with us. It is a discipleship process that goes beyond just gaining more knowledge and trying out some new practices. In the Gravity Formation course, we go below the surface of our lives so that we can notice and name our deepest desires in God's presence and to discern how God is at work in those desires to lead us toward holistic flourishing, more transformation, more life, more joy, more love. We've trained hundreds of people from all over the world in this formation framework, and it's helped many people to have a sense of God at work in their lives and learn to be more at home in God's love. If you'd like to learn more, go to gravitycommons.com/formation.
Let's get back to the show.
So let me see if I'm picking up what you're laying down here, Nathan. So critical race theory, I'm trying to summarize, because this is way more complex than most of the people who think it's a boogeyman. Like, it's just a, you know, like you said, there's people who empty it out. They just grab the name and they empty it out of its meaning. And they just, it's like a scary, look at the scary boogeyman. It's modern. It's, you know, talks about race. It's scary. So they don't really understand what it is. But in its essence, there is this way that critical race theory is helpful in helping us see what has been obfuscated. Like this organizational forgetting, I think you called it. Yep. Like it helps us see how white supremacy works, because white supremacy works best when it's hidden from us because we think of it as such a bad thing, and so we'd never want to be, like you said earlier, Matt. Like we'd never want to be, we don't want to be a racist. Hardly anybody wants to be a racist, except you know, if you're like the Proud Boys or something like that, who take pride in it. But like most people who do carry around racist ideas, they don't know where they came from. They don't know that they are racist ideas, and they don't know the harm that they perpetuate when they think, you know, I got to get this kid out of my class. Yeah. He's only here for one reason, and I know what it is. And so CRT can function as a way of helping us see how white supremacy works.
Yeah. And I was thinking too, Ben, just to tag on to that, when Nathan, when you talked about organized forgetting, my mind immediately went to the Capitol insurrection on January 6th and how I heard over and over and over again from politicians and leaders the phrase, "This is not who we are." And it was almost like, you know what I heard? I'm getting chills to even talk about this because it's so crazy. I hear that as, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain.
Like from the Wizard of Oz?
Yes, from the Wizard of Oz. Yes. And that's part of the myth that we tell ourselves anytime there's an eruption of the real, anytime who we really are is on display, it's like we cover each other's eyes and we say, no, that's not who we are. That's not who we are.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if I can add to, sorry, go ahead, Matt.
No, you go ahead.
I want to add to something that Ben said. And this is, in fact, going to take us to the third sense. I'll make sure I revisit the other two in a moment. But critical race theorists are engaged in an interdisciplinary mode of thinking through how white supremacy and law get connected. So one of the things that often cracks me up about some of the discussion about CRT is, I think I probably couldn't be a CRT scholar if I hadn't spent several years with Thomas Aquinas, because Thomas has such an enormous scope. But he's also outrageously fine-grained, and you see this throughout his masterwork, the Summa Theologiae. It's like, all right, so we're going to think about creation, we're going to think about God, we're going to think about angels, what angels do or do not have, what's an angel's will like, et cetera, et cetera. All, you know, getting all the way down to what kind of passions do human beings have, what are the different species of fear that a human being has, what are the different virtues that perfect them. Okay, let's now think about Christ and that's in the third part, et cetera, et cetera. So it was huge in scope, but also tremendously fine-grained. It's a similar sort of thing. CRT. I mean, people are drawing from literatures in history. Some of it's U.S. history. Some of it's Latin American history. Some of it's Asian history. Right? Some of it's Middle Eastern history. All sorts of stuff. And they're drawing from colonialism, decolonial scholarship, post-colonial scholarship. They're thinking with theologians. One of the founding pieces in CRT is a reflection on Dr. Reverend Martin Luther King Jr.'s theology. Okay, how do we think about his conceptions of law? It's sociology, psychology, it's all over. So when I hear people think that they have a real robust understanding of it, I'm going, I get paid to spend most of my days reading, writing, and teaching this stuff. And I'm still learning every single day. Mm-hmm. Because, for example, if I want to do justice to the part of CRT, it's about federal Indian law. Well, guess what? It's a steep learning curve. If you go from, I don't know anything about the U.S. laws about indigenous peoples to, this is a key part of the CRT movement. Now you're going to have to learn all this stuff. It's okay. So you can't even, there's no operating in a black white binary. You've got to know all sorts of stuff about Latinos, Latinas. You got to know all sorts of stuff about indigenous groups and various indigenous groups. So for example, I noted that the Lumbee tribe isn't federally acknowledged, but the Cherokee tribe, for example, is going to be, Apache tribe is going to be. So you're like, okay, well, what are the different ways in which the laws have operated to maintain white supremacy, not just against indigenous peoples as this big category, but in a more fine gray sense. So I say these things because the first idea is the CRT is that legal movement that we talked about. The second idea is, how does that legal movement travel? And then here's the third sense. The third sense is what I call the culture war sense. And it's so capacious and it's so amorphous, it's nearly impossible to define. So I'm in fact going to read a quotation that gives you an idea of what it is. But I note this because whereas I'm talking about making extended stays with text, I correspond with CRT founding scholars so that I can understand them. I want to make sure we're on the same page and I want to misrepresent them. I take justice to involve accurately representing your neighbor. These movements, in my mind, are sacred things in the sense that they develop out of communal pain, trying to understand how is it that we are subordinated, subjugated, oppressed, exploited, etc. Again, my family from Boricua, still a colonized people. We U.S. is going to be telling you all about the Revolutionary War. We can't have taxation without representation. My whole life, mi gente down in Puerto Rico have had taxation without representation. So these are movements and efforts to understand the world that are coming out of pain. And as such, I'm like, okay, I really want to be the sort of person that can enter into the sufferings and the sorrows of others. But note how that's going to contrast with what I'm going to now read. This comes from journalist Christopher F. Rufo, who's all about taking down CRT in scare quotes. But just listen to this. He says, "We have successfully frozen their brand, critical race theory, into the public conversation and are steadily driving up negative perceptions. We will eventually turn it toxic as we put all of the various cultural insanities under the brand category. So he's telling you, like a Lee Atwater, who we'll talk more about next time we're talking. He was one of the strategists for the Republican Party that constructs the Southern strategy. Right? He's just like Lee Atwater. He's like, let me tell you what we're doing. Here comes the next part. I mean, he's not hiding any of it. The goal is to have the public read something crazy in the newspaper and immediately think critical race theory. We have decodified the term and will recodify it to annex the entire range of cultural constructions that are unpopular with Americans.
Yes, it's the weaponization of CRT.
Correct. But notice, like, he's not telling you anything about the legal movement, broader history. He's like, everything is going to sound crazy. Yep. I want to have lumped under CRT. And the truth is, because of how various platforms work, because of how speaking circuits work and who's got time and so forth, well, this is exactly what's happening.
Yes. Mm-hmm. This is the same thing that, like, communism was used in the 50s and 60s and 70s right?
That's exactly right.
And now communism isn't the scary boogeyman because the Soviet Union's fallen and China. So now it's CRT.
Yeah, that's one of the main things that's going on. And notice, though, CRT gets lumped in with Marxism, cultural Marxism, communism, socialism, et cetera, et cetera. And let's be honest, if you talk to most people and you say, okay, so you're opposed to Marxism. Well, which school of Marxism? They go, I don't know what you're talking about. Yeah. And I'll say, you know that no CRT scholar fully endorses Marxism, especially what we might call classical Marxism. So Marx's own views. Because Marx is an Aryan white supremacist who doesn't want to center race reflection.
Right.
He wants to have class as the central unit of analysis.
Yeah.
Well, there are what are known as class crit scholars. So they're people in the CRT movement. They want to make sure that they don't lose sight of the importance of class, no doubt about it. But they're going to be like, oh, yeah, Marx gets all sorts of things wrong. Yeah. And even somebody who I mentioned earlier, Cedric Robinson, his book, Black Marxism, the final third of it's all about how the black radical tradition that I talked about Derek Bell being connected to, every single one of the leaders ends up looking at Marxism and saying, here are some things that are good. Here's a whole bunch of stuff that's just wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So Du Bois is one of his most important books, Black Reconstruction of America, written in 1935. He's like, Marx could never have, given his analysis, given his presuppositions, have anticipated that enslaved people would be so important for reshaping the world and promoting revolution. Mm-hmm. It's not possible on Marx's actual conception of the world. So I say this because then if you know, when you get into broader things, what I find is people are like, well, it's just critical theory. And you ask, okay, well, which critical theorists do you think is shaping these people? And what era of the critical theory movement? And did you even know that the critical theorist folks, typically they're Jewish people trying to understand Nazi Germany racism?
Yeah.
So, like, did you see how racism is prevalent there? Like, how might your relationship to their reflection on law and consciousness change if you realize that many of these people are Jews trying to think through the horrors of Nazi Germany?
Yeah.
But again, there's no broader awareness of these truths. And people think, well, if I can just say it's CT, and since CT is bad, and CRT is bad, and now I'm done.
Right. So part of why we're having you on is to help our listeners not fall for this cynical strategy.
It's a dirty
saying,
trick.
It's dirty. And it like that quote is astonishing. It's astonishing in its audacity.
Yeah.
Just to know that can be a public strategy, you know, that is just it's just no big deal. So it's super cynical. And it bothers me. So anyway, so part of what we want to have you on is to helpfully complexify this issue for people so that they don't end up dismissing something that would be so helpful for them and for their church and for their repentance, like something that would be so helpful, by dismissing it because it sounds like that scary thing that, you know, that one article that I saw, you know, on the one website told me not to read or not to pay attention to this stuff.
Yeah.
So I'm glad you're spending this podcast and the next one with us. Everybody, thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Leadership Podcast. At the end of this episode, I mentioned that Nathan was going to join us for this episode and one more, but just to be clear, that this has ended up being a four-part series. And so we recorded these conversations a few weeks ago, and we're really excited to bring this whole series to you. So next week is Nathan is going to get into a history, a brief history of white supremacy in the United States, going through just facts, just like stuff that people said. It's incredible. So that's going to be a two-parter, actually. So that's over the next 2 weeks, is a brief history of white supremacy in the United States. And then the fourth week of the series, we're just going to talk about why this all matters for the church, why it makes a big difference in terms of how we minister and how we practice leadership in the church today. So looking forward to that. I hope you can join us for those. And yeah, like and subscribe, you know, all that kind of stuff. It really does help other people find the podcast if you leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, etc. We'll see you guys next time. Peace. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Leadership Podcast. If you're finding it helpful, we'd love it if you'd tell your friends about it.
Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode.
Joining our Gravity community is free. You'll get our latest content delivered straight to your inbox, as well as an email most Fridays with curated links to articles we found interesting or helpful. To join us, go to gravityleadership.com/join.
Our show is produced by Ben Sternke and Matt Tebbe. Aaron Sternke edits and mixes the podcast, and you can check out his work at aaronsternke.com.
We'd love to hear from you. To record a question or comment for us, go to gravityleadership.com/message and click the Start Record button.
You can also email us at podcast@gravityleadership.com. Catch you next time.